Hi, and welcome back to another episode of The Jump Seat. My name is Chris Glass. I am a product owner here with Flight, and I am with...
Lauren McKenzie.
Lauren McKenzie, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So, Lauren McKenzie, I was started out as Canadian Airlines, but about right now I'm currently working with Flair Airlines as a senior consultant for regulatory affairs.
Excellent. And from what I understand, you're a bit of an entrepreneur now as well. We'll get to that a little bit later on, but tell me about that role as well.
Sure. I'm also the president of CSAT, which is the Consulting Services for Accessible Transportation Incorporated. And I created that just after I left WestJet when COVID hit. And then recently, because of obviously lots of recovery through the last couple of years, just launched the website. So we're now officially open for business.
Excellent. I was just on your website the other day and it looks pretty slick.
Yeah. Well, we've got over 100 years of aviation experience and all my favorite folks from the industry who have committed their lives to the industry and to accessibility. And we'll talk about that later.
Well, and since you brought up the 100 years of aviation experience, a lot of those years are your experience. So let's talk about how you got into this industry that hooks us all for life, it seems.
It's addictive. So I started my entry into the industry brand new. I had no aviation experience whatsoever in Beijing. I started the city ticket office for Canadian Airlines.
Wow, I didn't know that. I've known you for a long time, and I didn't know that.
Well, I lived there for 10 years. I'm fluent in writing and speaking Mandarin. And
I knew that.
And I my experience there was, of course, China back in, 1996, was a bit of a revolution happening. They were just opening up to the world. They were starting to get more interest in the North American carriers network. And my role was to teach customer service, because you got to realize when you got a billion customers on the other side of the counter, you don't have to be nice.
No, you just have people coming up no matter what. Yeah, yeah.
So I had to introduce them to the concept of, okay, you need to be nice to people. They will come back to you. It's really good. So it worked very well for 6 years. And then I decided to come back to Canada to start the, I took over the base for Victoria for Canadian Regional.
Okay.
So that was startup number two. So my role at Canadian was to get services launched and get the airlines operated. We operated a DC-10 once a week. Got to realize this is post 9/11. All the U.S. carriers kept flying. They said, I know there's nobody traveling, everybody's, but we will continue to fly to China. All the Canadian airlines, which was us, pulled out because, of course, nobody wanted to go when you couldn't travel and because of the security. But by pulling out, we essentially offended the Chinese government, and they made us keep our DC-10 on the ground for 7 days, paying per diems to 13 people in the Gobi Desert. It wasn't good.
So you would land and have to keep the plane there for seven days.
One departure a week.
And then take off.
You got it.
Keep your people there. Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was crazy. So that was just the world that we lived in. After we started flying again, we put the 76 on daily. We could charge $8,000 for a one-way business class. So there was plenty of interest to fly to China after that.
Yeah. And that was really Canadian Airlines' stranglehold in Western Canada.
100%.
Was the Asian routes and kind of that Asian gateway.
Yeah. And that's why when Air Canada eventually took us over, it was for that lucrative market.
Right, 100%.
And we lost everything, of course, from hemorrhaging in the East. So,
of course. And then okay, so then you came back to Victoria.
Yep.
And then what was next?
So now I'm into the Canadian Regional, which is the feeder airline for Canadian. And right about then, the merger took place. And I moved from Victoria to Calgary to start what was at the time Air Canada Jazz, which became Jazz, of course, with all the four regional carriers consolidated. They wanted us to go to Halifax to set up Air Nova's headquarters. But I was born in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, and I wasn't prepared to move back east at that point. So I stayed in Calgary, and guess what started next? Zip.
Yes.
So Zip was like...
most colorful ULCC at the time.
Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about Zip.
So we thought, okay, let's create something inside of Air Canada that can take on WestJet. We needed a 737-200. We need flashy colors, denim t-shirts. I even had a job. I had safety and security and regulatory and uniform fitting. I had the wackiest jobs ever. They had just, okay, what's
happening? And they were bright uniforms.
Oh, you remember the denim shirt and the t-shirts? Yeah, it wasn't pretty, but it worked for the purpose. And so, but that, I think, like you were talking about, a startup, you just do everything. So that was my opportunity. Now, actually, when we did end up shutting it down after a couple of years, because there's some interesting creative, let's say, use of resources that we were trying to do, and it was violating some union rules, so we shut it down.
Right.
And that's about when I the WestJet was looking to launch international services for the first time.
Right.
And I got invited to help them with that. So
before we leave Zip.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me what it was like. So you were involved with this kind of scrappy upstart under the Air Canada umbrella.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about that experience and how successful or unsuccessful or, you know, like I know you've told me in the past that it was quite a competitive fighting brand at the time. So give me a little bit more on that.
So first of all, I was trying to use resources. So you had flight attendants trained as CSAs, CSAs trained as call centers. So if you ever had somebody sick, you just swap them out, which was obviously a violation of union.
Yeah.
But we were, I think, one of the first carriers to do the electronic flight deck. We had laptops, and one of my roles was to update the laptops with all the Jepsons and all that stuff loaded on there, and then go around when the aircraft land. I'd swap out the laptop, put the new laptop in. They'd say, thank you very much, and off they'd go. And obviously, you had to do it to keep currency for logs and all that stuff. So very leading edge back then, but oh my God, these laptops were heavy, and it was not a new technology.
So Zip was a bit of a laboratory for trying out new technologies and whatnot.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Excellent. And so the decision was made to shut it down. Was it made because it wasn't profitable, or?
So we were right about to launch Laughlin, our first point outside of Canada, which again was the model to, you know, we wanted to take on all of WestJet. And of course they had transport at the point. They didn't have transport at the point, but they were going to.
Right.
And so we said, let's be the first. Let's get Laughlin out there. And so I believe the intent was to grow the Zip fleet. Obviously, union issues and other matters came in, and the aircraft were reallocated. So they just said, "Well, it's not a viable opportunity right now. Let's park it, and we'll see where it goes from here." So,
right,
and that was the end of it.
But it created at least a beachhead in the Western.
Yes,
yeah, excellent. Okay, so you leave Zip.
Yes.
To come to WestJet. So you dedicate your career to killing WestJet, and then you decide that is not what I want to do. I want to help them survive. So tell me about how you became a WestJetter.
Well, that's a fun story too. So, of course, coming from Air Canada to WestJet, I was not deemed to be a viable candidate because, of course, they're the enemy.
Right.
But they also recognize that because of my number of startups to date, that I could help WestJet get to the U.S. And so it was a battle between airports and flight ops. Who's going to get them? It was a manager of regulatory affairs, and they're trying to say, well, we need you more for airports to get them started. No, we need you to get the approvals and operating
certificates. So now WestJet has bidding war for you.
Yes, it was phenomenal. Okay. And this is the only time I've had 10 people in an interview. I have VPs right down to management. And they were like, so can we trust this guy? And I believe it was Dale Tinovey and some of the other guys who said, look, he's a squirt. He's good. He's fine. You can bring him on board. And they did. And then there was no looking back. And that was 2004.
So 2004, WestJet does not fly anywhere outside of Canada other than the occasional charter,
I suspect
charter. But on behalf of other companies.
Correct.
So I'm assuming you picked one destination, decided to just focus small and go all in on that? Or did you decide to do, I believe, 12 stations at once?
So my original letter, you have to get designation first. So designation gives you the ability to fly to a country outside of Canada. Then you need a license, and then you need the approval from the other country, and you get all those approvals. I did, I think, 30 countries when I did my initial designation application. I'm sure the government of Canada is like, oh my God, we got some competition out of this. This is phenomenal. Yeah. I got them instantly. Like, there was no hesitation to get it. So once we got the designation, then the next question was, and WestJet was very disciplined about its growth. You remember how we didn't just throw aircraft out into the world. We'd see if it made money, then we put them there. It was all about the profit, not just the revenue. So we were very strategic, and we started adding points in the U.S., and that became very quickly and a very large transborder program. And of course, the Caribbean was right after that.
Yeah. So what was the most difficult station to launch in your time?
Economically, I think most of the countries were willing to have new services come down. It's generally southbound traffic, lots of revenue for the tourism. But the northbound challenges, a lot of these were brand new entities for us. And I got to tell you, there's some serious operational concerns, i.e. drug trafficking and human trafficking and some of those other highly volatile scenarios. So we actually had people killed when they tried to put drugs on the plane, and they were, you remember that. So, I mean, it was scary. And we had to have somebody come and oversee the people who are overseeing our aircraft in order to be, have some kind of assurances.
One of our products here at Flight is called ClearPort, and it gives you real-time access to when doors open and close. And a lot of carriers in the Caribbean and certain parts of Africa are very concerned about doors being open in off times.
Exactly.
Like, why is the cargo door being opened right now? Exactly. And they get an alert from us. Can you talk about kind of how that operation works down there? Like what does a naive airline have to think about?
Well, unfortunately, you get to take your lumps generally. You learn as you go. But I would say in retrospect now, what you really want is some third party or objective system. Ideally, technology would be the best solution because it's not as fallible as humans.
And, can't buy off technology.
Yes, exactly. And you can't have them put the cocaine in a locker. It's not pretty. So that would be an essentially take away your concerns or at least mitigate to the best of your abilities.
Right. Sure. One of my favorite things to do as a continuous improvement analyst when I had downtime in Toronto was to go sit by the Montego Bay flight and just watch the operational issues with not understanding that marketplace.
Sure.
So can you tell me a little bit about how unique that particular flight was? Because I remember the stories of people checking in engines and low-flow toilets and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So,
well, just to bring it more relevance, I'll talk about sort of Flair's launch to Kingston.
Oh, sure, yes.
So same sort of scenario. It was interesting because having watched the Jamaican experience in my past and have them sort of say, well, what should we expect in terms of our new launch service? And I said, just be prepared to bulk out for every flight.
Yeah.
Because the volume of checked baggage, carry-on baggage is going to exceed everything. First day of operations, they're like, the ancillary revenues through the roof. We set records off the chart. People were willing to pay. And it was like, wow, there's a learning curve for you. That's how you do it, right?
Right. And then the poor guy on the other end who had to try to load all those bags.
I can't imagine what below the wing would have been like. I can imagine there's bulkheads all the time.
What was the most unique thing you ever saw checked in?
Oh, well, because I haven't been in the operation for checking and stuff, but when I lived in Jamaica, which I was planting gladiola corms to export to Cuba, and because you could get three growing seasons in Jamaica.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to back up a little bit. First of all, you lived in Jamaica?
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
Well, so that was part of an exchange youth program that allowed me to go and live in Kingston. Actually, I was in Mobay, and then they went to Lunenburg, and they came and we painted a mural on the wall in Lunenburg. And so in my time in Jamaica, it was just I guess it's true what they say about Rastafarians. It's a really relaxed environment, and enjoyed it very much.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Good. My wife is from, her background is Trinidad and Tobago, and they have similar issues with checked luggage going to Port of Spain. So it's always fun to watch the Caribbean flights as well.
They are entertaining and terrifying in some cases.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Caribbean was a fun challenge for you.
Yes.
And then what happened? What was next for you?
Well, then it was wide body season, right? We got into the 6-7s, as you know. You remember Gatwick's launch? And so that was the next round was Europe and all the member states that we wanted to fly to.
What are the challenges? Like, I mean, starting in Victoria, for example, in Canada, versus trying to get landing slots and timing into Gatwick. What are the differences? Like, what do you have to think about when you're launching a station like Gatwick?
For sure. So, like a Victoria, it's not slot controlled. They'll have curfews.
Land whatever you want.
Exactly. Yeah. But they won't sort of regulate because of the volume. Obviously, a Gatwick or a London Heathrow is a very different scenario. And in fact, some of the slot purchases, I mean, we're up to £1 million for some of these initial slots just to buy the right to get in there. So you had to be very careful. Obviously, you've got to make more than £1 million to get that revenue. So the challenge, of course, is and we're an unknown entity. We don't have a code share partnership. We didn't have an interline at that point. We're just starting to serve. And we thought, well, we don't have we don't know who's who in the zoo. And that challenge of getting up to speed on what do I need to get into London was probably the biggest challenge of getting there.
Wow. And then you started with the 767s, moved into the Dreamliners.
Yes.
And then where did your career go?
Well, we were guns a-blazing. There was no end of the growth at WestJet. We had every intention to global domination was our mission, right? And then COVID hit.
Right.
And that was a bit of a game changer.
Yeah. And so COVID affected my career. It landed me here at Flight. Yeah. And I'm quite grateful for that opportunity. COVID also landed you somewhere else. So talk to me about that.
Sure. So right off the bat, you sort of say, well, now what am I going to do with my whole 18 years of my life is just evaporated.
In an industry that doesn't look like it's going to recover anytime soon.
Grounded, literally grounded. So I knew other airlines were not going to be hiring. That wasn't an issue. So I said, well, I have all this years of experience. What can I do? And I had a real passion. I was overseeing the accessibility portfolio at WestJet.
Yes.
So I had a real passion to help remove barriers for people with disabilities. So I thought, well, I'm going to start my own consulting company. And it was Lauren McKenzie Consulting at the time. And then I worked for the CTA for a little bit. And I worked at different airlines and sort of patchwork until the industry started to pick up. There was not a lot of growth and interest for that. So when, I'd say this year, and certainly the last half of last year, you saw material growth. People were coming back. We were hiring again. The industry is starting to show some life. And what I created after that was what I call consulting services for accessible transportation. And what it does is, and my mandate, and hopefully we're going to revolutionize the way people with disabilities are engaged and paid. So past history, airlines were required to engage people with disability to review training materials and to look at procedures and make sure website's accessible and all that stuff. But they were given, here, we'll pay for your flight, but you got to pay for a hotel at the other end, or we'll give you a gift card opportunity to win a gift card in a lottery.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no compensation being paid. And I used that word, remuneration paid to people with disabilities for doing their time and effort. And I think that was absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
So CSAT's mandate is to say, well, if we're going to engage people with disabilities, A, you will be paid, and B, you will stay in the engagement until its conclusion. That means you may have numerous iterations of a policy or procedure until they're signed off saying this works.
Yeah.
That's when they're disengaged. In other words, the history was you get somebody at the beginning and say, okay, tell me about your travel and experience and I'll try and do what I can to remove barriers. Then they were removed and then the carrier went off and did their thing and that was it. I believe they should stay in that the entire program.
Right.
And our friends and our colleagues over at the Canadian Council of People with Disabilities, they agreed with us. And now they are their transportation committee is our advisory group.
Everybody in Canada has a right to mobility.
Absolutely.
Can you walk me through some of the hidden barriers that, obviously you could see the barrier of small aisles, cramped quarters, small seats.
Restrictions,
but what are some of the hidden barriers that people might not be aware of?
Sure. So right off the bat, let's think about those with invisible disabilities or disabilities that are cognitive or mental. You can't physically see some kind of evidence that they're struggling with some condition. And so what you want is an awareness at your front lines to say, be aware of this possibility. People will show up and you need to know, how do you ask them for help? How can you be of service to them individually? And that's so critical because that's a problem with it. You know, broad brush, everyone's so unique in their own skill sets and their own development. You can't just broad brush this sort of thing. So that's one thing. The training is critical to help avoid the unexpected. Another one is often I use the wheelchair as an example. Person with a wheelchair, it's a mobility disability, and they will be obvious. It's the ones like language requests or multiple sclerosis where they may be young, but they can't stand for long periods of time. And then they're like, well, I need a wheelchair. And say, why? You look perfectly young and healthy. Well, it's my legs are killing me because I have MS. That is another example of some, just again, it's awareness piece to make sure you capture all groups.
Right. So what kind of work would an airline have to do in order to, I guess, free up air travel for everybody, not just able-bodied people or people with visible disabilities that are relatively easy to figure out.
Exactly.
I remember back when I was a CSA, this going back 20 years ago, but I was a bigger guy, like a stronger guy. Yeah. So I used to get called down to the gate all the time
to help
with carry-on guests, where you literally lifted the person as dangerously as humanly possible, carried them a couple of rows. If you didn't throw it in your back, you got them down right. So and it would always be the same two guys because they were the only two guys who could do it. I know we've come a long way there, but what if I was a fictional airline starting up now? How would you advise me in order to, without giving away all your secret sauce, what steps would I have to take to make sure my airline is as accessible as possible?
Well, I got to say it starts at the top. Okay. So your executive have to believe
that they have to buy in.
It's intersectionality, it's inclusivity, it's we are a carrier to carry all people. And that means your mentality has to change to be inclusive so that when you're developing your website, you're thinking of the blind and the deaf and the ability to get, you know, relay services online. That's the thinking that has to start and has to come all the way through. If it's not at the very top, you won't be able to force those front lines because the executive will always say, do the minimum. What's the law require?
Yeah.
And then you end up with this highly restrictive environment where it says, well, I don't have to do all those stuff that should be done, the right thing to do. I'll just do what's the minimum. And that's the cheapest way to do it. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is that mindset isn't there when they show up at your counter. And it's like, well, I got to do this, I got to do that, but I don't want to. I don't care enough, right?
Yeah.
And now I got to say, one of those strengths at WestJet was that we did care and I truly valued it.
Yeah. You know, and hearing you talk about like the lowest possible standard and what's the cheapest, I guess, is probably what people think about. But I think of the cost of an electric wheelchair and how mishandling those, and they're not really made for the airport environment. How do you go about training to deal with some of these 300-400-pound devices that need to go downstairs and get into the hold of an aircraft?
Well, we did a lot of good work with IATA, and I have to say the CTA was a leader in that, as well as the National Research Council of Canada, to do a lot of research and investigation on what are best practices in terms of moving mobility devices, particularly the heavy scooters. And we engaged the manufacturers of those scooters and those mobility devices to say, what do we can do to make them less, more rugged, I guess, but more easy to disassemble and protect so that carriers don't have damage and people don't obviously lose their legs when they land.
Right. I just remember having to wrap those batteries up and every single device was different. So
yes.
It created such a panic amongst everybody.
Exactly. And that's why this working group created these passports. And they are literally a document that says this chair has all these features so that the ground handlers would know what to do with it. And the agents would say, here's what I need you to do to prepare.
Yeah. So everybody would be ready and on the same page.
Exactly.
Which airlines in the world do you think are doing a really good job at this?
Wow.
And who is the gold standard for accessibility in the world?
I have to say there's been significant improvement. There are a lot of carriers have invested heavily. And the one that springs to mind would be Alaskan. Okay. I've worked with their team for many years, and they were always the more innovative sort of willing to spend the money to try out different things, including new technologies. I think they were the first one to have this device that could box up a device so that it wouldn't be damaged on the aircraft. Yeah. So that I thought was sort of leading edge. So I've always felt they were.
So Alaskan's cutting edge. That's excellent. What kind of technologies other than that device have you seen? What have they been trying out?
Well, then you're starting to go further afield and you're looking at the looping technology for people who are deaf. They can go through terminals and that kind of walks them through in a verbal sort of a visual a description of what they're moving through so that they have a guide. The automated wheelchairs that they're looking at in Winnipeg now, that put in your gate and you get in and it just takes you there.
Wow. So you don't have to have, the hardest part.
Resources.
Is you'd have five agents at the counter. Somebody would show up needing help to the gate.
Exactly.
And now you have four resources at the counter and
I can't lose them.
You can't lose those people.
Sure.
So Winnipeg has self-driving.
It's where it's being trialed.
Okay. So walk me through that.
Well, it's not part of my trial. I can't tell you who's actually leading that, but I've seen that kind of technology out there.
Excellent. Well, that's going to be a game changer for a lot of people.
I hope so.
You're also advising for another airline now.
Yes.
So talk to me about that.
So for Flair.
Yeah.
So Flair, of course, is a ULCC that it is, I believe, one of the biggest barriers to air travel for people with disability is the cost of air travel.
Right.
And they're often on subsidies. They're often struggling to get income. And so you get these large tickets and you can't travel. That is a physical barrier to you being able to travel.
Right.
And then what I've seen with, so ULCs, I think, play a very important role to get people traveling, to get them out of their homes and get them on planes,
right,
which I think is awesome. At the same time, their focus is on cost. So that balance of trying to say, okay, how much can I spend on this to get everybody on the plane without raising the tickets so high that now I'm just as I just created a new barrier somewhere. And it's actually in the law that you cannot create new barriers when you introduce removing barriers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the legal framework has always supported this. And it's sort of the, and this goes back to CSAT as well, which requires, it says nothing about us without us, which basically says if you're going to talk about people with disability for policies, procedures, you better involve them. You need to engage them. And that's the law as well.
There's nothing like a bunch of people making decisions for a group of people who aren't involved.
We've been there, yeah, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Flare and their ULCC model and where they are in the industry right now. I know the ULCC market just saw Lynx leave the marketplace. It seems like Flare is the last ULCC standing in Canada.
Well, at the current time, I would have to agree with that. Yeah, it's never good. We've been, I think, that, like I said, I've lost five of the airlines that I started. They're just gone. And it's heartbreaking. These are people's lives that are being impacted. But I got to say, I'm optimistic for Flair that it's going to be the ULCC for the foreseeable future to be that mechanism for people to travel, both people with disabilities and otherwise.
I see your CEO often in the news talking about opening up Canada with low fares.
Mm-hmm.
You've been a part of opening many different bases. Can you shed any light on what it means to cities to have ultra low cost traveler airlines flying into their bases?
So we've done numerous studies that, and I know we did it in previous airlines, that show when you launch a new route, what is the economic impact on a community? Yeah. And I think we've seen significant increases in, for example, the Kitchener market, which wasn't served as frequently as we currently do today.
Right.
And the impact to the economic region is phenomenal, just in jobs and income alone. But it also opens up opportunities that didn't exist before. And I love the fact that we can take people out of Kitchener and fly them to warm and sunny destinations in the middle of the winter. So I love the ability to be able to do that. And I think the ULCs are instrumental. If you've watched the cycle of ULCs come in and then they grow and then they become big and guess what? New ULCs enter. I believe that is a natural cycle for this industry.
Yeah, and it seems like Canada is... It doesn't seem like it. It is. Canada's far behind the world in providing a fertile ground for ULCCs to be successful. From Zip, from the days of Zip, from the days of Jets Go, we've seen so many companies leave the marketplace that are trying to make it work. What are some of the barriers that a ULCC in Canada faces?
Well, unfortunately, it's not just a ULCC problem. We're talking things like APPR, which is the Air Passenger Protection Regulations. Understanding there's sort of a phase in from a small carrier to a large carrier and that, you know, there are some different requirements. But at the end of the day, the onerous cost to the carrier to pay out for the compensation is in fact a barrier. So the fear, of course, is if you're selling a $49 ticket and somebody gets $500 in compensation because of an irregular operation, it's logically not good for the long-term viability of ultra-low-cost carriers.
Yeah, it has no... A lot of people don't know that. They they don't know that the APPR payouts have no tie to the ticket price.
Correct.
So it's disadvantageous to offer a low fare in a lot of ways because if you're late, you have to pay so much more.
Sure. And that, let's not forget when it comes to... And I understand, that, for example, the ATPDR, the Accessible Regulations, have a maximum fine of $250,000. So the intent is to be a deterrent to obviously comply with the law.
Yes.
sadly, in the event that somebody does get a penalty, none of that money goes to the individual. It goes into the general revenues of the government, and then the benefit doesn't experience by any of the people impacted. So, and it's obviously a huge cost to the airline, which completely they should have complied with. But at the end of the day, those costs are significant, and they add up very quickly.
So APPR is a factor. What else is working against airlines in Canada? This is going to be a topic coming up on our pod quite a bit in the next little while.
Yeah.
So, and you have a unique background as a governmental regulatory affair expert, if you will.
Sure.
So what else, what other barriers are facing airlines?
Well, you have your normal economic barriers that protect the Canadian travel industry from abuse from other countries, for example. You have your bilateral agreements, and those sort of set out in the series of articles what's allowed for services between two countries. But I have to say that my experience is working with Transport Canada Air Policy, they've always seen as Canada's interest first. And I like the balanced approach that we want to have more business, but we can't have it at the expense of our Canadian aviation industry. So I have to say they've done a good job of doing
that. We don't want to have an American carrier come in and just fly Calgary, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, and that's it.
You need cabotage protection so that they can't come cherry pick the routes. Absolutely. But in terms of the broader, you know, barriers to the industry, I think I hate to say this, the aviation industry is a huge money laundering business. We generate tons and tons of revenue and spend tons and tons of cash. So the margins are just microscopic.
Right.
So that is probably one of the greatest barriers to the entry of the business and the sustainability of the business.
Right. If Apple had the profit margin of an airline, they'd shut down tomorrow. There's no way they'd operate.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's probably, it's an industry systemic, certainly here in Canada, I would suspect across the world.
And you have the high costs of buying aircraft, high costs of
huge
fuel,
cost of assets,
high costs of staff.
Yeah.
And that's before anybody pays it.
Yes. Yeah. The infrastructure to set up an airline is unbelievable.
So moving forward, where do you see the industry going from here when it comes to accessibility? First of all, when it comes to people with disabilities. Yep. So that's the first question. And then where do you think it's going to go when it comes to fares and new entries in the market?
Gotcha. So for people with disabilities, I'd love to be able to say post-COVID things are getting better and people are starting to fly more and people are experiencing less barriers. Sadly, because of the impact on the airlines, because of COVID, they're still in a restructuring format that is trying to get their head around what's the new reality going to be like.
Yeah, they burnt all the furniture during COVID. They're still trying to rebuild.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, a lot of history was lost. And a lot of the people who had that experience and helped to create what I believe was an excellent trajectory for accessibility is kind of a reset now. And so there's a whole bunch of new folks in the market and they're starting to learn again. And so I'd say if I was to be a person with traveling today with a disability, you're probably going to have barriers, more barriers than maybe even you experienced pre-COVID. And that's unfortunate because what happens is you have bad experience, you don't want to travel again, or you hear bad experiences. And so you stay home, and that breaks my heart because I think everybody should see the world.
Right.
So that's one. Secondly, again, back to the compliance piece, the stick isn't working. So I believe the better way to do this is involve those people with disabilities so they're part of the solution throughout and they feel in control. A lot of times they just feel like they're just little incidents at the beginning, then they're not involved again. And that is also breaks my heart.
If I'm somebody with a disability and I have an experience that is suboptimal, what do I do?
Ah, great question. So obviously the first thing you do is you go to the airline and or this travel service provider and say, I didn't have a trip that met my expectations.
Right.
I had an experience that was less than desirable. They resolve it or don't. It's a very simple, can I satisfy your needs? Can we make the policy change, a procedure change, or whatever it takes? And if you can, ideal. Problem solved, everybody wins.
Right.
The downside is that keeps happening. And all these industry changes aren't systemic. And so the goal with CCD, Canadian Council to People with Disabilities, and CSAT, is to create what's called a social enterprise, to create where everybody's inclusive and it's intersectional. It's because you got to realize it's not just the disability. They could have LGBTQ and they could have other considerations that are challenges to their travel as well. And so all of that needs to be systemically done. And we believe the best way to do that is through engaging all these folks at the ground level.
Excellent. Where do you see the barrier to cost? What's the next step when it comes to ULCCs in Canada?
That's a challenge because now you're looking at your the usual costs, which all carriers pay, but it's the fact that you're trying to be creative and push the envelope all the time, be it on onboard services, ancillary revenues, all those kind of, and that is usually met with resistance. There's a lot of, when you start thinking out of the box, there's like, I'm used to that. I want that. And this is how you break the industry to make it grow and make it evolve.
Right. And then what's the future hold for you?
CSAT is my primary. I will continue to push for growth in that area. But I'd like to stay involved in the industry because I love it. I love what Flair's doing to change and grow the ULCC market. And I love what WestJet's doing to rebuild itself and re-identify itself. So I just love to be part of this experience.
Well, and this is not an industry that anybody leaves easily.
No.
So you lived in Beijing.
Yeah.
You lived in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the world all across. I like to ask everybody, what's your favorite place to see? What's one place that me as a traveler that maybe I haven't thought of, or where in the world should I go next?
Sure. Well, I had the pleasure of being, because of WestJet's expansion program,
of course,
5 continents before I was 50. So I have the world to choose from. And I got to say, one of my favorite countries was Costa Rica.
Costa Rica, okay.
And the one I loved about it, the people are genuine and authentic and friendly. But it had the ecology, the environment. You had volcanoes and beaches and jungle. And it was just sort of this mecca of, what do you want to do today? Well, let's go see a volcano. Let's go to the jungle. Let's go hit the beaches. Had everything. So I like that.
Wow. That's so the next trip I need to take my family of five on is go to Costa Rica.
I think you'd have an awesome time.
Awesome. Lauren, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It's always great to bring on guests that have interesting stories and interesting backgrounds, and you really fit that bill. So
thank
you so much for spending some time with us today. We'll be back with more episodes of The Jump Seat in 2024. Thank you.